I have the pleasure to introduce Siegfried Linkwitz, but in fact I think everybody here knows who Siegfried Linkwitz is, because who did not yet hear about the Linkwitz-Riley crossover filters?
That's him.
This was developed out of a shared hobby with Russ Riley, but it's audio. And earlier is, Siegfried was working also with frequencies, but with much higher frequencies when he was still working 37 years in research and development for Hewlett and Packard. He developed state-of-the-art electronic test equipment such as microwave spectrum analyzers, network analyzers, and EMI receivers. These are much higher frequencies, and anyway, frequencies and waves. And the simple thing is they have shorter wavelength, but the laws are the same. And so today, after having retired in 1998, he continues to pursue his long life interest in audio and particularly in loudspeaker design. His goal is true to the original sound reproduction in normal living spaces from his perspective. I think that's something which interests all of us, and I had already the pleasure to witness that. I'm very interested to hear what Siegfried is going to explain. And he says, loudspeakers and rooms are known, are now understood and done. I think that's true. Microphones were done some time ago. Unfortunately, also this is true, even if I believe we could still try to make them smaller. But there is a majority of users who don't understand that large diaphragm means less good. But that's another point, and it's not my party here. Next point is, appropriate recording practices are finally understood, but not yet commonly applied, and I can only agree again, and now I want to listen to what you say, Siegfried. Thank you.
Thank you for the introduction. As you see, the title of my talk here is really a two-part talk. It's hearing, loudspeakers, and room, so that covers a pretty broad subject. And we'll start with hearing first. And I just would like to make you aware that as you entered this room here, pre-consciously, you already were processing acoustic information. You got in your brain already an imprint of what the reflection patterns in this room are, whether it's big size, small size. If you, of course, you have eyes, and so you have the visual inputs, but if you were blind, if you didn't have this, you would get a lot of information about the space already. That's important. Also, there probably were noises in here, people were talking, which caused reflections in the room, and those reflections, I'm sure you also used to sort of scan the room, the radar, like a radar, the size of the room, so a lot of information was gathered here, pre-consciously. And I say this because hearing is such an important sense, in addition, of course, to sight and all the other senses that we have, because it tells us something about the space we live in, how big it is, and what else is there, very important, what else is in the space, who else is in the space, because that could be important for how we behave in the space, whether we run, whether we stop, what it is. It is whatever we hear can cause emotion in us, so it can also cause motion, like I said, you know, like here, this is not a good place to be, this is not friendly. So all these things, I think, are important to cover and talk about, because hearing, surely, not just in humans, but in animals, is a sense that is used very much for survival, in addition, of course, to communication there. And when it comes to survival, what is the most important thing to recognize or to sense? That is, if I hear a noise, I right away want to know, from where is it coming? And usually, and you can observe yourself, we instantly turn the head in the direction of where the noise is coming from. Okay? So that's one ingredient there. The next thing that is very important to know is how far is that source away? Okay? And then you would want to know how big possibly is the cause for the source here. Once you have identified the source of noise there, you know, some direction, distance, and so on, you need to keep track of it there. So we all do this here very quickly. You need to understand what's the meaning of it. Is it a threatening source? Is it a big thing? Is it a mosquito? Is it an elephant or a tiger? Or what? Is it a bird? And you need to decide whether to continue to pay attention to that particular source, or say, okay, this is just part of the background of the environment that I live in. So a lot of processing happens in the brain. It happens between the ears, and this is sort of a look under the skin. And it's a gray matter up here that is really where oops, excuse me. I cannot use this, let's go back here, back. Oh my God, okay. Let's see if I can get the mouse working here and have a little better control over the pointer. Okay. So up here, that gray matter, and we have two transducers you can think of, which are the ears and the outer ear and the shape of the body. That determine the air pressure signals arriving at the eardrums. From there, the air pressure gets converted basically into electrical signals which get fed to the brain. And we are very good at dealing with the signals here, these space sensors here. We are going for intensity differences. I list the whole thing here, arrival time differences, envelope variations, spectral masking. I'm sure you have all heard all these things. We use stream segregation, pattern recognitions, we pay attention or not attention, we learn, we have memories, and we also use other parts, other senses, like we move our head, and we have tactile and visual inputs there. Now, I think it would be fascinating if you had been given the task of designing a computer program where you say, okay, here you have two sensors, they are spaced a certain distance apart, depending on where sounds come from, the different responses there. And now, within 20 milliseconds, upon receiving a sound, tell me whether the sound is something threatening or non-threatening, make a good estimate. And then you have maybe another 2 seconds, tell me how many sources are out there, you know, from how many sources do I receive sounds. And it has taken a few million years, I guess, of evolution to perform this task there. And I know that Microsoft would be more than happy if you could offer something like this to them. You know, it would be very useful to recognize copy protection type issues and things like this. You all know about the precedence effect, the first arrival of sound, the Haas effect. And just to illustrate as an example, here I have a plot of the threshold for one and two reflections. And what you have to see here is you have a direct sound arriving from say, the frontal direction, and a reflection coming off 36 degrees as R1. And there's an interesting general behavior of all these precedence effect type curves. And that is that there is, for the first 20 milliseconds or so, the first reflection has to have a rather high level before it would pull the direction from which we think the sound comes from. Okay? And then after that, there's a steep fall off, meaning that we become more and more sensitive. In other words, a weaker and weaker sounding reflection will pull the sound more towards direction. And that makes a lot of sense from survival. Like 20 milliseconds or so corresponds to a distance of about 7 meters. But if you go beyond that, that you're sort of beginning to explore the range past this radius of 7 meters there. And it's very important whether this source maybe has moved or isn't really where you first estimated it to be, or whether it is some other location there. These processes are going on all the time. They are hardwired to a good extent into our brains, but the brain is also plastic and adaptive and can change. Goosey, but still Goosey's processes there. Now, let's talk about not so much hearing, but a situation that we have when we play back stereo. Two loudspeakers in a room, and recognizing that the same hearing processes still are going on that were used or evolved for survival. Now you have two real sources, very important, two sources, the two loudspeakers there. These two sources illuminate the room and cause reflections in the room. Okay. What we are really interested in is that out of these two loudspeakers comes sound, and that sound is supposed to give us an illusion of another acoustic space, say a concert hall, with instruments and voices in there. So we want to reproduce in this living room space the acoustics of another space. And this other space, of course, appears only in the form of phantom sources. The sources are not really there, even though, you know, we think from this direction or that direction. Some of this is going on in the room here right now. I mean, I come to you at least from three directions, from left speaker, right speaker, maybe some directly from my sounds there, and it would be really a highly confusing situation if you didn't have the visual input and knew that the source is sitting right here. I don't know. I don't think the top speakers are running, but certainly these two on the side and two on the side here. Okay. So here we have the picture, two loudspeakers in a room, and the reflections. And when we know and have experienced it many times, you put mono signals or two equal signals into left and right loudspeakers, like the singer and the other crowd, and we get a phantom image, say, exactly between the two speakers, between the two, exactly between, only, of course, if we are sitting on the axis of symmetry. And note that the distance is somewhere in the plane of the speakers or behind the plane of the speakers. Why is this so? If you listen to the same recording over headphones, where is the source appearing? Inside the head. If you set up these two loudspeakers in an anechoic chamber, where does the source appear? Inside your head. The headphones are no different than an anechoic chamber. They are no reflections. The reflections are an important part of positioning the source out in front of you. That's a very curious thing. And I give you an example of something I experienced here a year ago at the AAS San Francisco convention. And it had to do with the presentation given by Robert Schulein about binaural hearing. And the same presentation, by the way, is being given tomorrow morning here. And I highly recommend that you go and listen to it. Because it gives you some sense of how we hear, how binaural gives spatial distortions. And in particular, the distortion is that sounds from the front are located inside the head. Sounds from behind are easily located outside the head, but in front is inside the head. And after hearing this presentation, I was approached by someone who said, I have a difficulty localizing outside the head with these headphones on. And he said, I can give you a demonstration with head tracking. And I want to just briefly describe it because it was a really key experience for me. So he put on the headphones and he played a piece of monaural, some jazz concert. And sure enough, it appeared right between the ears inside the head. Then he said, I turn on the head tracker, and we're calibrated for zero, and nothing happened. I sort of looked around, eyes closed, so I didn't want to be distracted by physical thing there. And then all of a sudden, the sound was in front of me. It had traveled, you know, from inside the head to outside. It wasn't clear distance of, and I pointed to it where it is. And then I turned around, full 360 degree, always pointing at the source. And as I turned around, the source was fixed outside the head, smoothly, no change in perception. And then as I had turned free around, pointing towards the source there, he said, now I turn off the head tracking. And as I looked towards I looked towards that source, it was still out there. It didn't move, it was clearly outside the head. And then they said, well, that's really curious. It's still there. So I started moving my head again. Nothing happened. Still out there. And I did it again there. And then all of a sudden, the sound source that was out there, I could sort of sense it was sliding towards me. And all of a sudden, whoops, it was right between the ears again. Now, here's an example how in the tracking experiment, I had received cues, the proper cues at both ears, of where the sound source was supposed to be, just a head-related transfer function. Okay? And when he had turned off the tracker, my brain still remembered, it was convinced it was out there. I had to give it fresh cues, which said, no, it's not out there, you know, by moving my head again, and then the source moved inside the area. Very key. Think about it, you know. Oh. So, reflections. Reflections are very important. Reflections are abundant. I want to emphasize this. And in particular, I want to like to talk about dipole loudspeakers. And here's a photograph of a dipole loudspeaker in a corner. It's like the corner simulated by mirrors. And you see images. And everywhere where you see a driver, you see sound coming. So there are plenty, plenty of reflections. And here on the right top graph, you see a measurement of such a speaker in the corner, a 3 kilohertz tone burst applied to it, 50 millisecond time window, and you see all these peaks there. Every one of these peaks is a single reflection, lots of them. Below it is a frequency response over a 200 millisecond time record for this point, the speaker in the corner. Okay, the thick curve there is the actual response, the curve on top is the third octave averaged response curve. You would say, well, this speaker could use some help. It's not flat like I would like it to be. There's a real temptation to flatten out the speaker there, but I say it sounds not like it looks. It sounds flat. Okay, it's very clearly flat. And if you equalized it to be flat on this graph, it would clearly have too much high frequency output. Now, as it turns out, these reflections are important, and this is something we may not agree with here, but I just tell you something here that you might consider like little magician's tricks or so of what you have to do so that the loudspeakers in a room are not influenced by the room. And some of this may be surprising. Of course, we know that the direct and reflected sounds determine what we hear in the room. Clearly, that's no question about that. We also know, and that's totally intuitive, that you have to have some left-right symmetry. You know, the speakers need to be symmetrical. You need to be on the axis of symmetry. That's just one of the limitations of two-channel stereo VFR. But the next point is that the loudspeakers need to be at least 1 meter from the closest reflecting surfaces. Is probably not so well appreciated, and that goes back to the precedence effect and the way we hear here. Because what happens then, and I should add the next point here, that is important, that each reflection needs to have the same spectral content as the direct sound. In other words, that the reflections are copies of the direct sound. And that is a requirement that is rarely ever met with loudspeakers, certainly not with these types of loudspeakers that you see around here. Now, if those loudspeakers are at least 1 meter away from walls and you have more than 6 milliseconds delay, then the brain comes into place, and just as in the case of for survival, it can disassociate the room from the direct sound coming from the speakers. In other words, the reflection which describes the room, which always repeats, it's the same description, it's always the same thing. So the brain can tell, well, the room, that's just background. That is the background. I don't need to pay attention to it. It's a very important thing that we can do. We can pay attention. It's almost like if there is a ticking clock in the room. Maybe when you first came into the room, you noticed. After a while, you don't notice anymore that there's a ticking clock. Because the brain has said, well, there's nothing of interest here. I can suppress it. But curiously enough, then when someone says, do you hear the clock clicking? You probably can't get it out of your brain again, you know, because now you're really paying attention to it. And so these are very important points, and almost like a magician's tricks, they are required to eliminate the room so that you can really focus on the direct sound, which carries the information about the voices, the instrument, and the venue in which those elements were recorded. And here's another thing that I have tried very hard and could not fully explain. I've given a paper on it also, is that when you go into the bass range, the range below 150 hertz, that I have found that dipole bass speakers produce what I would describe, and many other people have described, a far more realistic reproduction of bass than what is typically used here in the box speakers or so, even the big ones, it doesn't matter. Okay. So, how are we doing for time?
Well, still 10 minutes to get.
Okay, wonderful. So, given these observations, that that's really what it is that I'm describing here, we can ask, well, what does a loudspeaker have to do? And it has been, I think, pretty well established that the loudspeaker has to have a flat on-axis response in free field, and I cannot overemphasize, in free field. I don't even measure a loudspeaker in the room because I wouldn't know how to interpret what I'm measuring. But these days, that's done very freely. People measure the sound in the room, take an equalizer, make it flat, or some target curve. I don't know what really is going on here. And a loudspeaker has to have a frequency-independent polar response. Now, that is a very tough requirement. Very few loudspeakers have that. Certainly, this type of loudspeaker doesn't have it. It's omnidirectional at low frequencies. It's more and more forward-firing at high frequencies. There, of course, directional loudspeakers, well, we get into that. In order to get a frequency-independent polar response, you pretty much require that the source, the drivers in the loudspeaker, have to be acoustically small in size. And when I say acoustically small, I mean like an eighth of a wavelength or less. And that's again, is a very difficult requirement. You also have to have low cabinet edge diffraction, low stored energy or resonances, low nonlinear distortion, so that you do not generate new sounds, because that's all what nonlinear distortion means. You generate sounds that were in the original. And it has to have another thing that most loudspeakers don't have. It has to be able to have a large dynamic range. Because unless you play back at near realistic levels, you will never get a full impression of what was real. No, the illusion will always suffer. You cannot miniaturize a symphony orchestra or whatever the sound source is. You can do it with a guitar, that's easy to reproduce, but not with a big orchestra. Okay? And all this, again, is essentially now to hide the room and to hide the loudspeakers themselves so that the brain can totally focus on the phantom.
Oh,
it
just fell off.
The screen.
Oh, perfect. Much better.
Am I still on? Did I destroy the microphone? Okay.
It doesn't crackle anymore, that's good.
And the requirements for the room are really not that major. The room has to have a certain minimum size, otherwise you can't move the speakers out from the walls. So that determines sort of the minimum size. Yeah? You want to be about a meter away. Now, the acoustics, I would say, have to be rather lively, or what I would consider normal for a living space, a space where you feel comfortable to be in, not a muffled type of space, but also not some open hallway where it's very clangy and reverberant. So we're talking about the 400, 600 millisecond reverb time, if it even makes sense to talk about reverberation time for small rooms. Okay? Now, the next points that we'll go through rather quickly here, you can build those loudspeakers, and the easiest way to build this type of loudspeaker is to use a dipole. Omnidirectional also works, I have demonstrated that, but the omnidirectional inherently will illuminate the room more because it radiates every which way, so you have more reflection. There is a limit to the reflection. Same like you wouldn't want to have an anechoic chamber, you don't want to have a reverberation chamber type situation, okay? So it's somewhere in between. And so the woofer can be easily built. It requires 60 dB per octave equalization, but that doesn't mean it requires much power to move the car. On a 12-inch driver, it may take 5 watts to get to full excursions down at 20 hertz. The power is required up when you go into the 80-100 hertz frequency. That's where it takes a big power. The mid-range, let me go back, the curve on the right is a theoretical dipole with a 60 dB per octave, and it's shown at 0, 45, and 60 degrees. And you see there is above, when the distance between front and back D is one wavelength, you see in this region above you get nulls and peaks, cancellations and peaks there. And that's really the region that you would really not want to work in, but you would have to work in, because you can't physically, you can't build the speakers small enough there. So this is what you have with the mid-range. And you also get some other phenomena, like at the low end of the mid-range, you see it in the graph below, if the response follows 60 dB per octave, but then it actually peaks, has a region where it has a peaking in there. And then you see above, you see like on here on the graph, you see a notch. What helps is that if you take your typical 8-inch driver, for instance, that if you look at the polar diagram, as you go up in frequency, the polar response actually widens. Unlike what if you take the same driver and put it in a box, it always narrows. Here it widens, and then it's because the back radiation from the backside of the dipole comes around, and the phase addition makes the response wider. In the tweeter range, if you want to get significant output levels, you just about have to use something like dome-type drivers. But the baffles are so big that you need two domes, one for the front and one for the back, and they don't really communicate front to back with each other, except at large off-axis angles. The baffle is too big, the drivers themselves become directional, and so you get sort of what I would describe a dipolar-type response, but it's not really a dipole in the sense that you have the interference causing the noise of axis, 90 degrees of axis. Okay, and so let me just summarize, and that is that whenever we deal with acoustics, we need to respect the natural hearing processes. And otherwise, you cannot optimally create an illusion. And that's all what we are after here. The loudspeakers should be designed to illuminate the listening room with equal timbre for all horizontal and vertical angles. The loudspeakers should be placed at least 1 meter from the walls. Loudspeakers and listeners should be set up symmetrically relative to adjacent boundaries. And the final point here is the loudspeaker, in my observation, is far more problematic than the room. People like to think about that they have problems with their living room, and they say, no, you have a problem with your loudspeaker. The loudspeaker does not illuminate the room properly. Because I can tell you from a lot of experience, you take a well-designed dipole, you put it in a wide variety of rooms, and they do sound the same, which is really amazing. You know, I can pretty much guarantee it will sound. Now, this is not true when we talk about the large panel loudspeakers, because they certainly, the electrostatics or magnetic panels there, they certainly do not have well-behaved polar response patterns. They are physically just too large for compared to the wavelengths that they're in. Okay. Now, it's tempting to think about what you can do once you have a loudspeaker room system here with recordings, and I say this because now having a speaker like this, you find out what recordings engineers are doing, and that is oftentimes very questionable, in my opinion, because now you hear the space that is that the recording was done in, and oftentimes it's an totally artificial space or a collection of artificial spaces with artificial reverberations there. So our brain is smart enough to say this is a, something is not right about it, and now you can hear it. It's very clearly. So the question comes that what are we doing in recording that makes it so wrong, in my opinion, and isn't there a way to at least do it right so we don't have to be too creative when it comes to recording, but at least know that it could be recorded just like you heard it in a concert hall, and that is what Don Berger will talk about next year. Okay. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Turn over.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.